Julian Assange will be up ASAP, and meanwhile we're playing some music. Please hang on. Huh?
Andreas, heb jij de track?
Thank you.
Oh,
good show.
Thank you, Brent.
Great.
Oh, hang on.
Wait for it.
Oh, no, he's not waiting for you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is another edition of Righteous Ranting at the Omroep. And bear with us for a moment. I'll first throw in some music, and then I'll introduce our guests as far as they have shown up so far. So here they are. Here comes some music to chill out. Metropolis by Night by Chill Carrier. Again, good evening, and well, hello, my name is Walter, and let's first introduce our two guests, well, two for the time being. I hope the other two will show up later on. Typical Chaotic Radio making here. Bilal, could you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Bilal. I currently crash couches in San Francisco, and I work around in the Middle East on helping form community spaces or hacker spaces or whatever they prefer to call them.
I think hackerspaces, makerspaces, it's the same thing, but nonetheless, let's move on to the next guest to introduce himself. Let's go ahead.
Hello, this is Bicycle Mark here again. I was just here in the previous radio program. And for those who don't know me, I'm a journalist and sometimes known more as a citizen journalist. I have a podcast, a weekly program called Citizen Reporter. And I also do a program together with Tim Pritlove called News of the World. And I teach new media and journalism skills in different parts of the world the last few years in parts of the Middle East and North Africa.
So, thank you very much. And finally, our two other guests have arrived. Catherine, if you could be so nice to introduce yourselves.
Sure. Hi, my name is Catherine Marr. I'm with Access, International Digital Rights Organization. And I think that since the topic of the evening is the Middle East, it would be useful for me to explain that I lived in the region for quite some time, in Egypt for 2 years, and in Syria and Lebanon, and have traveled around and done quite a lot of work, both from sort of a digital security perspective, but also looking at some of the roles that technology has had in transition and post-transition societies.
And there another one, another American who has gone native to some extent. Jillian, go ahead.
My name is Jillian York. I work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation as their director for international freedom of expression. And a lot of my work focuses on digital rights in the region, including helping young startup groups that are working on these issues kind of amplify their voices or help them with capacity building. And I also do policy and security trainings in the region as well.
Okay, thank you. Bilal, to start off with you, and we're going to have a fifth guest as well, but she'll introduce herself somewhat later on as well. What would be, according to you, the biggest challenge for people in the Middle East who want to do stuff on both on civil liberties online or just being a hacker in general?
I think one of the biggest challenges is realizing that they're not alone. I think a lot of people maybe sitting in their houses or in net cafes, maybe connecting to some communities very far away and not knowing that they have people within their local communities that would want to participate and become a part of these initiatives as well. It's a cultural movement and it's slowly spreading, but it certainly has already made an impact on a small community of people in the region, and finding their friends is probably one of the biggest first steps and one of the first challenges to confront.
How can that be in the internet age?
How can it be that they don't find each other?
Yes.
It's because they think that they're the only people on the internet. I don't know. It's a strange thing when you're on the internet, you just don't think that people are real potentially.
It happens to me all the time. People will say, don't you know about, you're interested in, name a country, let's say Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, and they'll say, don't you know about this key citizen journalist or scholar? And sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I think the thing is, sometimes you're just really busy in what you do, and for sure you have your network, and sometimes it expands, but still, it's your network. And there's just so many other people doing similar work, yet you don't know them yet.
Yeah. I think these things like OHM and like hackerspaces provide throughout the year are really important to be like, dude, oh my God, Bicycle Mark, you got to talk to Catherine. You know Catherine, right? And of course, you might know
you
Catherine,
do.
But
yeah.
Like, you don't know Raja or Sara Sabai, who are working on some really cool projects in Beirut and probably like a part of the region that you're interested in. And like these physical manifestations of the digital communities are really important. And
so. I just want to add, I mean, I think that it can also, I mean, for me even too, be kind of intimidating. Like, I think a lot of what I've watched, some of these groups coming up over the years or blogger communities or whatever, I mean, this goes for a lot of the world. This isn't particularly unique. But just the idea of kind of coming into that from the outside where you see these established communities or there's, cost barriers to coming to things like this, to international spaces. And so I think a lot of that too makes it difficult.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. The sort of isolation of the beginners in this space is the second wave, second generation, as opposed to the people who had broken the paths originally. who have these incredibly high profiles and are seen as leadership, and it's kind of finding the space and for these newer people to come in and say, you know, this is something I'm interested in too, and what's my space and what can I contribute, and how do I connect with those leaders, and how do I connect with other people who are interested in what I'm doing?
I want to get back to the notion of leader later on, but Sarah, you dropped in. Could you please introduce yourself? Welcome.
I'm Sarah Sabai. I'm from Beirut. I'm an educator, and I'm also from a hackerspace in Beirut called Lumba Labs. Yeah, pretty much.
A hackerspace in Beirut. How is that? I mean,
that's
the
very
situation right
and
now
everything
is
else.
Slightly
it's great.
Tense, I understand.
The internet's slower than everywhere else.
there's
that's
an
not
idea
a nice thing to say.
It's like, no, it has like the second, correct me if I'm wrong, second slowest internet in the world after Botswana?
I think it's second slowest upload,
time,
right?
Mm. Once upon a time. Okay. It's moving up in the world. It's like
I was asking
seven.
A question to Sarah, by the way.
I don't even know what the question was.
The question, what's it like to run a hackerspace in Beirut? I mean, you have armored personnel carrier vehicles standing around the corner every other week. If I understand the media correctly, you're looking at me appalled, so I'm probably understanding them wrong, or our media are screwing up things again, or both. But
that actually has nothing to do with the problems we actually face in a hackerspace. I think those are just problems everyone faces, but people live technically or generally very normally. We go to our work, we go to our family, friends, we hang out, we party. All of the shebang.
Beirut has a reputation for partying, indeed.
But the problems that we do face actually have a lot to do with culture. The idea of a third space, like a hacker space, is not very prominent there, and it's very new. So a lot
what
of people.
What do you mean by third space?
A hacker space, which is like neither your work space nor your family, your home space. So
which one would be your first space, by the way?
The family, I guess most people. The place where you wake up in the morning, you're like, oh, hey, people, I live with you. And then the second space where you spend also a lot of time is the work, or if you're a student at the school or a university. And a third space is like a community space where you're neither at work, you're neither with your family, but with a bunch of people, you're socializing, you're doing things you're passionate about, you want to see happen in the world.
Well, let's say the Lebanese are not any less football crazy than anyone else in Europe and the Middle East. That would count as a third space as well then, wouldn't it? Your local football club.
Sure. I don't know how many local football clubs we have. I mean, I think we need to... There's not a lot of spaces like that, community spaces, local clubs. There's actually not a lot of that. We're crazy about it. We do it at school. We watch it a lot. But the community spaces like that, like sports clubs, arts clubs, they're not that prominent, actually. Something we're trying to spread.
I would extrapolate that immediately to civil society, which probably is less of an existing thing than as well. I mean, that's kind of to me as a given that you have that kind of additional...
But that's not a third space. That's also jobs for a lot of people. Civil society, NGOs, that's a huge employment base for a lot of people. It's not necessarily a third space.
I would
space.
Say speak for yourself here. But
that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's great. It's creating jobs
for
people.
No, to me, it's a volunteer thing.
Okay, I see what you mean.
Behind every professional civil society person, there are literally tens or hundreds of volunteers.
Not the ones I know about in Lebanon. That doesn't make... Volunteers are great to do some of the general stuff, but most of the people in NGOs actually work there, and that's what keeps them going, because volunteers can't live off. I mean, yeah, people need to make a living in places like Beirut. They can't live on volunteerism or internships.
Well, and I'm actually supposed to moderate the discussion instead of participate that much, so, but nonetheless, it's my bloody show. To me, civil society is about people participating in how the society is being run and not leaving it to professional politicians or professional NGO people. And Gillian and Catherine do not take that too much as an insult, at least I hope they don't. I will hear it afterwards, I suppose.
Isn't there just a line at some point where, you know, you have professionals doing something, but you also have civil society? You have both, right?
Yeah, there's not sustainability unless you have some degree of professionalism, right? Volunteers are wonderful, but they come in and come out.
There should not be professionalism in civil society. To the contrary, I mean, European civil society tends to lack professionalism, but you can't have a civil society that relies only on professionals.
I mean, I'd actually be kind of curious and sorry to jump in, but I mean, when you asked the question, I had sort of thought that the question was like, what is civil society like? And I'd be curious to know what your thoughts.
So I actually used to work at an NGO. I don't anymore because I don't know if I believe in their work anymore, but I just don't want to participate in it anymore. But what it's like in Lebanon is there's a lot, first of all, there's so many NGOs in Lebanon, and they do everything the government's supposed to do. But because our government is inactive and they just keep fighting because it's in their benefit to keep fighting and pretend that they don't get along, NGOs take their jobs. And that's not necessarily a good thing, but they do what they what they need to do. And some of them work on policy and like trying to fight the current laws in state. Others work on the ground. Others just do a lot of workshops and trainings, and they get huge funding, huge funding pumping into the country. And that's being spent on employment, on actually salaries, and on doing these workshops somewhere in a mountain. We get people from different sects and religions, and we do interfaith dialogue or conflict resolution. And after that,
sounds like
goes
an
home.
NGO industrial complex.
Sorry?
It sounds like an NGO industrial complex.
Yeah. So I actually hear some of your concerns because I was right where a bunch of new money is coming into a bunch of new NGOs in a refugee camp in Syria. And some of the people in the camp were talking about their concerns about how the money is being spent. They're feeling like some people are trying to keep the problems brewing because there are people benefiting from money coming from abroad. Do you hear some of those concerns when you were there too?
Were we present for one of these examples? We were online for dinner. This is a good way to relate to what we're doing here to camp. We're online for dinner, and as it happens at OM, amazing things happen. People come up to you with something, and someone came up to me with the Waka Waka light. Yeah. And he showed me this solar-powered light. It's quite affordable, and apparently they've distributed it in Syria and another country, Haiti. And and he said, towards the end of the explanation of the Waka Waka light, he said, "Oh yeah, and so there are this many in Syria, and there's more coming. It's funded by the Gulf states."
Yeah.
And you lit up, or the opposite of lighting up, at that moment.
Bent off on a tangent.
Keep me away, dude.
You don't want to talk about it? No. And then the light lit up. I got it wrong. It wasn't Bilal. It was the light, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, but it's not just about like where the funding is coming from. It's people within those NGOs that are abusing the funding. Like I saw a mansion in Qah. Okay, it was like a 2-story thing with like amazing like concrete whatever giraffes or something on the outside. It's like, what is this doing here? Why is this here? It does not make any sense for this to be here. And then I was talking to some of the people that I was with, and they were telling me like, dude, okay, I don't know if you think what I'm thinking, but like there's a lot of shady business going around. You know, this refugee stuff. There's some people making some serious dough, son. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Serious dough. And then he was like, okay, so look at this house. It's like 3 stories. They probably got a basement.
Where are you hanging out?
Hopefully they got the money on halal, which means like they didn't like do anything wrong. But like, I don't know what it's doing here either. And so I hear your concern about NGOs being a place where...
I was just merely asking a question. I was just concerned trolling you.
Go ahead.
All right. But I also see Sada's point about people in the Middle East needing funds. And this is actually one of the things that are needing funds to live, right? And doing something good with their time and also making a living is pretty awesome if they can wing it. And this is one of the sustainability problems of the hackerspaces, right? A lot of people in the spaces that we're starting up are like, okay, now we make money, right? And because they have some needs. I don't know if you have anything to speak about.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
That's one of the hugest problems we face at Lumba Labs, the hackerspace in Beirut, is the ongoing concern or the elephant in the room in every single org meeting we have is, how are we going to sustain ourselves? How are we going to pay the rent at the end of the month for this space? Maybe one of the problems is we haven't yet found a space that's cheap and available to us, because there's no such thing as spaces like that in our country. And there, every little spot of land is taken over and something is built on it to make money out of it. And so, yeah, that's one of the, that's if not, not the war, not the build, the bombings, none of that. It's just how do we pay for this? It's
just,
really economic.
Just your average run-of-the-mill hackerspace.
Right. Pretty much.
Yeah, same concerns.
Well, yeah, this is basically what about every hackerspace that I have seen so far is, well, it very much depends. it's good to live in a real estate collapse country.
Yeah.
Hackerspace wise.
Berlin seems to be doing okay.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Detroit.
I was just gonna say.
Detroit would be an excellent place to get loads of hackerspaces.
Which is happening.
Yeah. And they have loads of old hardware lying about, haven't they?
It's kind of perfect. So I grew up in Michigan. I grew up just outside of Detroit in a little-ish city called Ann Arbor. And during the collapse in 2009, I saw this ridiculous, if you look at hackerspaces.org and you look at the graph representing the number of hackerspaces over time, you see this elbow. It's like some guy making a big fist. I'm like, pff, right? And that elbow happens at the same time as everything collapses, because there's three things that flooded the world. There was empty spaces, there was cheap tools from factories that were closing, and then there were a bunch of smart people like, now what, right? And they started buying those tools from the factories that were closing, and they started putting them into some of the warehouses that were closing down. And Detroit's really awesome for that. And actually, I think there's something that I've been thinking about, right? I'm looking at Detroit, and I'm looking at the Middle East, and I'm seeing these kind of cities that were once grand, like Cairo, holy shoot, right? Seriously, you walk down in some of the really nice places that in Cairo's history, you're like, this probably looked amazing 40 years ago.
Paris on the Nile, right?
Yeah.
Well, but getting from the Paris, Beirut has been called Paris of the Middle East. And I'm asking this question to Catherine. How likely is it to have hackerspace popping out Tehran? I mean, overeducated population, collapsing economy.
I mean, I don't know that I'd be positioned to answer that question. I've never been to Tehran or Iran. Certainly, if you're looking at what Bilal was just saying in terms of like the three indicators of hackerspaces, you've got these really smart people, you've got a real estate drought, and you've got available technology, then it would seem to me like it would be incredibly likely that that would pop up.
Although I think, to be fair, we would be happy to be sent to Tehran do the research on this.
Absolutely. If anybody can arrange a visa.
If there are any funders listening in,
Jillian at EFF.
I would love to see an available Jillian.
Yeah,
Jillian at EFF.org.
That's
send me an
Catherine
email.
At Access Now.
Yeah, there you go.
But I'll do the easy thing. But of course, they've got the state apparatus, which is quite different from the other places we've been talking about. And I think that's the thing that gets in the way.
Let's get to Sarah then.
As far as you tie it to an ideology,
you have
a
state apparatus that is not entirely democratic either.
Well, I wasn't sure that's even functional. But what I would relate to what Mark is saying is that idea of culture. One of the problems we do have is culture, this idea that people can just come together and do things. That's weird for people. People come into the space and they're like, what do you do? And we try to explain, we give them the regular spiel, and then they're like, what do you do? Let us see an output. So that's really hard to kind of tell people about and get them.
So you're suggesting that the Lebanese are unaware of the concept of slacking?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but
I mean, if you go back a few generations in our own histories, depending on who we are, our grandparents and great-grandparents probably had no concept of slacking. I have long conversations with my 93-year-old grandfather. He has no concept of not working and not having some working purpose.
And if you substitute not working with church time, would it work?
With what?
With church time.
Being that third space.
Sunday. No, but I would say my grandparents spent, and my parents actually, have spent more time in church than I will ever spend in a hackerspace.
Mm. Well, it's different for everybody. In my case, my grandfather would actually skip it for work. But it's true. Many people would stop in order to go to church. But I don't think they considered that as, you know, not working. It was simply what you had to do. I get what you're saying, but
I mean, just think about the criticism. I mean, just to that point, think about the criticism that people of our parents' generation got for being artists or for, I mean, for any of that. You know, I think my parents would both tell me that those things were hard things to do, even if you had all of the talent in the world. So I don't think it's all that different to make a parallel there. And it's certainly, I mean, I don't know, I've heard it. No, I haven't personally heard it. My parents are always very supportive, but I've heard it from other people's parents about their jobs, you know, if they're not a doctor or a lawyer. And I'm talking about in the U.S. and in Morocco, where I lived too.
But I'm not sure that's different today. That's why it's counterculture.
Yeah, no, that's what
right?
I'm saying.
I think
exactly.
The definition of the artists, of the hackers, of the creators of the world is that they run against the grain. They're not the ones going to be the doctors. They're not the ones putting in the 10-hour, 12-hour, 14-hour days. Those people who decide to make that third space part of their life, both sort of as a job or outside of their job, or you know, infuse their job with that passion, are the counterculture. Almost every community in the world.
We'll pick up later on that. First, we'll throw in some music now. Hoodoo.
Yes.
I was just thinking that's what we needed.
Yeah.
Currently, the orchestra is warming up in the corner, but the thing is a little bit cold. Dutch evenings. There we go.
All right. This is indeed, like, your job. You're so good.
You're like, as a matter of fact.
Actually, it's what I do.
It is my job.
But I'm glad you said that, because I've been worried lately.
Are we being as part of the format.
What is? A song? What?
Chaos.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, no. I mean, I come from a country of chaos. This is normal.
Explain that.
Oh, you want more talking over each other? That's what
happens. Who speaks loudest is heard.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, like the Indian notion of traffic rules. Him who drives fast to the intersection has priority.
Yeah. This is good, though. I haven't gotten to have a long talk with you guys yet, so.
Yeah, actually, I kind of want to start talking about, you were talking a little bit about people not knowing how to slack off, but I think there are other more interesting principles within hackerspace culture that can be highlighted that are also not generally what's considered norms in these cultures, which is like the freedom to fail or the freedom to play and experimentation. Like these kinds of things are kind of.
Okay. We have 2 minutes left. We have 2.5 minutes. We have 2.5 minutes.
It's like musical chairs. Music stuff.
Oh yeah. I think those are some fun things to talk about, because that is also not a common thing in Muslim culture, in Arab culture. Like where I grew up, I grew up in the States. That's not what my schooling or my parenting or my family life was like. And I think that's the interesting cultural shift. Because that's the beginning of where I think new sorts of creativity and new sorts of solutions come about, but also at the same time, new sorts of cultures, new sorts of society, which are both things that we need for a better future. We need to like transform both our physical and our emotional landscapes to get to a place where we can actually survive together.
And it's not just in the civil society side too, right? Like that's in the private sector side too. You talk to people who are trying to become entrepreneurs and they face some of the exact same challenges with regards to like familial support, obligations.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got that much talent, you're not supposed to go out and start a startup. You're supposed to make sure that you're providing for the community, the family, like you're doing something serious. You're making your family proud.
Serious.
It's true, right? Shoot him down. Just get out there. You got your like your skeet shooting gun, and you're like.
Shoot away. You too. Like.
Yeah. What? Roger, come on. Yeah. Has Roger not introduced himself? Introduce yourself.
I was aiming for a middle-aged person. I'm not complaining.
I think this. It's good to actually have people from the Middle East on the panel. Like.
Yeah.
We've kind of like,
yeah.
We're tourists, or like we've
well,
lived there, or whatever.
Bloody colonials, basically.
Or me.
I'm the biggest tourist here.
Portuguese.
Who's lame dust?
God.
I can talk to you about theories of how Portugal is connected to the Middle East. Well, not theories.
I'm painting you guys a little Middle East. You want it? Middle East?
What?
You want a little Middle East?
I noticed that you've been really busy over there.
What are you doing?
Some watercolor action.
I have a napkin from dinner that he sketched up.
Look at you with that fan brush.
Okay, back to our panel of bloody colonials and friendly natives of the Middle East. And before the break, it was suggested that there was no concept of slacking off in Islamic culture. And then I remember I live in Rotterdam, which is a pretty colorful city with crap loads of Turkish and Moroccan tea houses. And how do you explain that bit, Bilal?
People like tea.
Wait, what are you talking about?
Backgammon is good.
Yeah. Coffee spread from the Middle East, right? Everybody likes coffee. I mean, things that are good go places. I don't know.
No, look, you were suggesting that this, and so you and Sarah were suggesting, and we have another bloody Mediterranean at the table. Roger is the name, is that correct?
It's actually Raja.
Roger. Yeah. Where are you from?
Raja, I'm from Lebanon. I'm Lebanese.
You don't look Lebanese at all.
Surprise!
Oh, boy. What do I
wait,
look
wait,
like?
What do Lebanese people look like?
Cultural preconception.
Intervention the other way.
Where do I look like I'm from?
Canada.
I will place you either in Portugal or Yugoslavia.
On behalf of Portugal, you're welcome to stay, but you don't look like us.
So the idea is that like I can't have a good
Galicia.
Economy.
Galicia will do.
Okay. Interesting. No, yeah. I'm actually 100% Lebanese.
I'm sure the Vikings left something behind there as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the Crusaders. It's always
Phoenicians.
The Crusaders.
Oh, not the Phoenicians.
That's right.
Right.
But anyway, there was here stated there's no such thing as slacking off in Islamic culture. And then I see all these old farts hanging out in the tea house watching television, satellite television, and nipping their tea, sipping on their teas.
I think that's a
good example of a third place.
No, I agree. Like, so the thing is, I think there's a separation between slacking off and kind of fulfilling a sense of duty. So basically,
it's a duty to be in a tea house.
Maybe no,
to that's be middle to old age male, basically
with a pot belly.
Critical.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, like, for example, when you have these families that are pushing for traditional jobs like doctors or lawyers, the thing is they feel like, as in because it's ingrained in the culture, that once you do these things, this is what you're supposed to do these things. Let's say you are a doctor, then yes, you've earned the right.
So it's the lawyers and the doctors that hang around to the tea houses?
Well, I don't think it's the same people. But the thing is, I mean, of course, you can't generalize, right? But the idea is once you become...
We're on the radio, of course.
You've gotten these, yeah, right.
Well, you can generalize, but you're usually wrong when you do.
Yeah, there you go.
Says the pot.
Yeah.
Actually, I think there's a lot of things about Middle Eastern culture that are really well-suited for these community spaces. I mean, they're a culture of hospitality. You go to these kinds of places, and they're welcoming. And that culture of slowness and that offering culture is just translating it into a place where you can say, hey, you know that stuff that you do when you go and somebody comes to your house and you're like, oh shoot, I gotta make them tea, I gotta make them food. What if you started sharing more of the resources that you had, or started like creating communities where you weren't looking towards guests from outside, but looking at each other as people that you can offer these types of things to, and extending it beyond food and to more parts of life? I think there's really wonderful things about Middle Eastern culture that help support community spaces like these.
So the thing is, like, I think gets in the way is that, for example, I'm more of an academic, like my background, right? So I'm pursuing my PhD. I spent most of my last...
Who here hasn't gone to university, by the way?
Ever?
Crickets.
There you go.
Crickets.
So the idea is that, like, my family actually doesn't... Oh, there you go.
Well, I think what you did counts as university. Our sound technician did a polytechnic, I think.
That still counts.
He's ashamed now. But...
So, okay, I mean, yeah. Like, for example, they don't consider pursuing a PhD. Like, my family doesn't consider pursuing a PhD legitimate. Like, I should go be working right now and helping support the family. And but they don't see the value of, for example, continuing something like research. So I think that's just separate from all the things that would be beneficial for hackerspace, like the hospitality, the ability to, like, take these breaks and go somewhere. But the thing is, you're taking a break to go somewhere and what? To make something? But the thing is, that making something isn't your job. And that's where the discrepancy comes in.
May I throw in a horrible question?
Go ahead.
To what extent does the remnants of tribalism hinder community-oriented spaces like hackerspaces in the Middle East?
Oh, that's... Well, I know... the thing is, when you have to... In Beirut, I mean, I don't know about the others... But in Beirut, it's like you have this space where all this where tribalism isn't an issue. That's something actually special. Like, it's actually special because tribalism is an issue. So that's one of the ways it sets itself apart. So unfortunately, where everywhere else, like, it's not an issue. Okay, hackerspaces, like many other spaces, there's not an issue with tribalism. But in Beirut, it is a big deal that you're overlooking things like sect and religion and all these things. And that's one of the good things about it.
I think the
I mean, the people who go or who are likely to go to a hackerspace are already pre-selected or kind of filtered by themselves. So, I mean, even in the NGO world, you will see the same people everywhere, the same activists ever since we're down in university. The same people that I know from uni that were active at uni in undergrad are now active in NGOs and volunteerism, and the same people went into the hackerspace. And so it's kind of a different culture already. These are very special circles.
What I meant with my question, Wu here hasn't gone to university because you're typical, very Dutch. Your typical Dutch hackerspace is mostly white, male, upper middle class, mostly flunked university students. having actually finished your degree is not that common, but by and large, I'm painting a rather wide brush there, and the way you describe it's not that different in Beirut either.
I think everybody who's in the hackerspace has completed university, is educated, highly educated, very critical, and I think it's actually better for people to be educated in Beirut. They're more likely to enter hackerspace if they are educated, because they're more critical of the status quo. Other people would probably be more complacent, more like, oh, I just need to make a living right now, it doesn't matter.
You're putting it like as a political statement to join a hackerspace. To me, it was merely but like, I don't have the space, and I may be able to afford a lot of the gear in the hackerspace, but it was not money well spent if I only use it once or twice a year. So why not pull some money for the bloody laser cutter to begin with?
I think it's for people in our part of the world, it's both. It's people who really want an alternative and who are making a point of creating an alternative and going to an alternative and spreading that culture, and also just wanting to do their own personal projects. But a lot of us who have been there since it started, haven't yet been able to do a project because we don't have anything in the space. So we spent all our time for the past 9-10 months actually trying to just make a hackerspace. So in that sense, it's still been political in the sense that, yes, we want to create a hackerspace, but have we yet been able to do any of the personal stuff that we want to do? Not really. And that's been really draining, actually. And that's largely also financial and the kind of basic needs that we haven't yet been able to meet.
And it also becomes a question of what happens next to some extent. Bilal, I think you were involved in helping out with hackerspaces in Egypt at some point. And I don't think that, you know, maybe the people that set them up and start them off, they may have something to do with university, they may be highly educated, they may have fit a certain profile depending on what country we're talking about. But the question is, who comes next? Because if you're a hackerspace with an active sort of outreach effort, then you can reach out to people who aren't of your world, academic world, be it to younger people, which I actually heard was possibly going on in Egypt.
We have repair cafes, for example. Repair cafes.
Mm.
People can bring in stuff that's broken down and too bloody expensive to fix, and volunteers fixing it. We're mostly hosting them, but there are other people from outside. But it's an excellent way to interact with other demographics than your typical white male, 20, 30 something, middle class fellow. But that's just something to throw in what we do, we happen to have.
You were talking about most of the people at Lumba Labs being highly educated, and then I remembered seeing the show and tell with a 9-year-old boy. Like, he wasn't yet highly educated. What's that?
I was talking about the core members. So the show and tell is another, it's kind of like the cafe repair thing where people can just come in, even if they're not, if they're not going to be there substantially throughout the next, I don't know how many months, but there are people that's accessible for sure. Like this girl brought in her brother who's 9 years old and he did some really cool project. And a lot of us were astonished and like, wow. It's definitely, we're trying to make it accessible. And that's been an ongoing conversation. How can we make this accessible? Again, it's so new that you just want to make it accessible for actually the educate. Like, just let's start there. And then we're fine to think about how can we get more, groups.
Another horrible question. I have the bias that there's less of a gender gap in the Mediterranean than in Northwestern Europe in hackerspaces.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Actually, one of the things we're proud of is that, there's a percentage of 40% of the members are female. It's very balanced. And that includes, engineering, students and engineering majors and things like that as well, which are also tend to be gender unequal. But we're very proud of the fact that we're quite gender equal.
I'm still wondering where the difference comes from.
Can I yes, just make a comment? This is just an observation. I'd love it if you guys want to challenge me on this, but I...
No.
My experience in spaces like this, I've been to Beirut, but I've never been to your space, is that they tend to be more progressive spaces than hacker spaces in the West. That's been my experience. With a few exceptions, of course, but I find that a lot of the hacker spaces I go to in Western Europe and in the US are a little bit less progressive on, politics is one thing, but just on gender issues, on things like that. And I don't know why that is. I'd be curious what people's thoughts are, but I mean, it may be the fact that there are fewer of these spaces, that they're more sort of concentrated amongst, like you said, people who are active in university, things like that. Jump in.
Yeah, no, I wanted to add, just throw something in as a point of like, to inform the conversation, which is that in the West, only about 10% of the tech community from like in terms of entrepreneurs is female. Mm. And recent data, which I just read a report saying that 35% of entrepreneurs in the Middle East, particularly tech entrepreneurs, are female. Mm. And there were a couple of reasons that this report cited, and it was things like, 51% of the graduates of university are female, but only 20% of the workforce is. And there are all these traditional structures that force females to find other means of engaging and other opportunities. But like technology offers people self-determination in the way that a traditional sort of hierarchy corporate structure might not. And I don't know if that informs.
Could it also be that women are more involved in the founding of some of these spaces than a lot of the older ones in the US? I mean, that's just sort of seems like an obvious point.
May I drop in? I specifically said Mediterranean because I have the impression that both Latin America is decided outside of Mediterranean, but for example, Italy, Spain, Portugal have a lot more female techies than... Okay.
That might be true. I'm just not equipped to...
We have a pet Portuguese at the table, so... You were Portuguese, aren't you, Mark?
I certainly am, yeah. I am not a member of any hacker space in Portugal, but at events and when we have gatherings, I don't see the type of numbers that you're talking about
But not the massive
35%.
No, 10% in the US.
Oh, sorry, in the West, it's 10% of entrepreneurs are female, and obviously 90% are male.
It's more in those numbers. It's not as progressive as it certainly should be.
Hackerspace I'm a member of is one or two in about 60 members is female.
I think what's going on is actually pretty close to what Jillian was saying about the foundation. It's like attracts like. It's one of the laws of the world. And I think people that are like
science.
Very, very
science.
Yeah.
He blinded me.
Oh, yeah. So I think there's this really cool thing that's happening where people that are studying hackerspaces in the fourth wave, whatever, as the waves go on, people are like, you know what? You know what was missing?
Ladies.
Wait, where are all the ladies at? You know what else was missing? You're like, why are all these like tech geeks just sitting at their laptops? Why don't we have like more open spaces? What about like accessibility issues? You know? And like these things that as time goes on, people modify the initial concepts. And you know, hackerspaces once upon a time, long time ago, Loft, L-O-0-PHT, was about like people dumpster diving computer parts out of a dumpster and trying to take down the internet in 10 minutes, which was really cool and like really super geeky and really elitist. Like these, okay, I'm sorry guys, Joe. But these people were like kind of really closed off. But the power of openness prevails. The power of data that wants to be free is like really, I think part of what is evoking and informing the culture that is evolving over time.
Do you think that that's an advantage to the spaces in the region? That the fact that they've come in at this point in time rather than 10 years ago?
Yeah, certainly. It's like, this is what Jepsy is like hoping to connect these places with other places and be like, look at them, look what they did, now do it better. Kind of things.
I think that's both a good and a bad thing. Because we're so new and young, we have very low self-esteem as hackerspace. We always try to look at others like, oh, how did they start? We need to start the exact same way or else we're failing. And that's one of the things that came up recently. That's one of the things I actually disagree with at the space is that they feel that we started off actually one of the reasons I think we're multidisciplinary is because we started off because we started off multidisciplinary, we did not have a very techie-focused space at all. We had art people, architects, poets, engineers who did not want to do anything that had to do with engineering in the space.
That's me.
That's him. Clay people. And so we had workshops on kite making, clay making, poetry, music, all kinds of things, and along with techie things. And that brought in a lot of females.
Isn't the world was looking at you as an example. I don't know if you guys know this, but like every hackerspace that I've connected with, that I've shared, I was like, okay, guys, listen. Last week, they had a cryptography workshop. Now they're making kites. And they're like, what? Are you serious? And I was like, yeah. And the board is like 50% female.
Kites are cool, man.
Yeah, kites are awesome.
But it's redefining what hacking is, right? Like, I feel like in
no,
the
it's
West...
not.
Well, no, not necessarily.
I've always said that Jim Hendrix was a hacker.
All right, so in popular conception, though, right? So I think that most people sitting around this table know that, like, hacking is just, is working on things, it's building cool stuff, it's repurposing other items for new ends. But I think in popular conception, I mean, we can now talk about the fact that hacking means breaking things to a lot of people, but even among a sort of a different class of folks who are a little bit more attuned to what hacking is still technology. And the reality is that you guys have completely redefined hacking, which is like, hacking is anything you want it to be. It's glass blowing, it's kite building, it's pot throwing, it's the whole spectrum of events. But I mean, if I can ask a question, I'm pretty curious, as a hackerspace, do you ever feel like you're sort of criticized for being too all over the place?
Okay, so
because I feel like I've heard that, and I don't think that's legitimate, but I would love to know how you guys deal with that when people come in and they go, but
do you want to talk about everything?
Recently we've gone through this issue, like, I mean, you hit the nail on the head there. One of the reasons we felt like we weren't being sustainable was one of the reasons cited by other members, because here it's kind of biased. Sarah and I both disagree with this, but they felt like they needed to narrow down the focus. And so is Bilal. He's starting to disclaim here. So they felt like they needed to narrow down their focus. In fact, as we speak right now, Lumba Labs in Beirut is becoming more of a techie hacker space. Lo and behold, the gender inequality is starting to rear its ugly head, even though, I mean, there isn't gender inequality like in university classes as much, but in engineering. But at the space now, you're actually having like this kind of discipline inequality, and it's showing up because they want to narrow their focus. And they felt that this was going to solve the problem of, like, you know, sustainability, because now we can, you know, we could focus on one thing, we could focus on our projects. People who are interested in one thing can come instead of being lost. But I think that's going to backfire, because one of the advantages we had were that we have these online communities, we have physical places where, you know, tech people can go. We have poetry collectives, we have art collectives, we have fashion collectives, we have architecture internship groups and things like that. So if you're interested in one thing, there are plenty of places to go. You just have to find them. And the people, if you're interested, you'll find them. One of the advantages we had was, I'm an engineer. I don't want to be judged by the fact that I have an engineering degree. I want to go somewhere where I could be an engineer who could do other things. That's why I went to the space. That's why a lot of designers went to the space. They're like, we like, you know, designing. We like making clothes. But these people can help us learn how to deal with basic electronics, so we can have, you know, electronic fashion. You know, the reason was you could get all these people together. So now that you can't, I'm not sure how it'll go. I think it may go the way of old hackerspaces from previous ways.
I think a proper hackerspace does cross-pollination. But Jillian has been aching to chip in
for a
while.
No, I mean, that was actually perfect, because I actually want to build on what you just said. I mean, I'll just say, you know, this is my first hacker camp. And
welcome.
Aw, thank you.
We popped your hacker camp cherry now.
Oh.
Seriously?
We're doing so well.
No.
Yeah. So I'm just going to keep going. This is my first hacker camp. And I'll be honest, like, I'm not a technologist. Well, that's not the part that's a confession. I think everyone knows that I'm not really a technologist, but I've worked in this space on privacy, on free expression, on policy in this area for a really long time. And, you know, for me, it's not actually about my gender. I'm less interested in dabbling in certain things. I'm less interested in hacking. I'm less interested in coding. You know, that may be because when I was a young person, that wasn't instilled in me. I'm sure there's a gendered piece to that. But for me, it doesn't matter. I like to be in this space, and I love what I do, and I love the internet. I've been on the internet since I was 11 years old. But, you know, I have felt intimidated by these spaces for a very long time. And I've been walking around today, and everybody's wonderful, but I would notice that Noisy Square, where we've been at, which has a lot more policy people, is so much more gendered balanced than most of the other spaces that I've seen here. And I don't know if that's, you know, I'm not going to get into people's personal things, but I think that first off, a lot of the women that are, you know, that I've seen hanging out up there that I know in the policy space are over 30. So we probably, you know, I think that younger women are being more encouraged into these fields these days, which is wonderful. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that there are all sorts of reasons, but I do think that that's one of the more comfortable spaces. And if we can be more inclusive like that and keep all of those other opportunities, whatever they might be, you know, I certainly learn a lot, and I've been kind of trying to learn more security stuff or more whatever.
Just hit the nail on the head? You said that these are more inclusive spaces that are cross-disciplinary. And okay, yeah. It's a pretty narrow slice of cross-disciplinary, ooh, tech policy and technologists. But nonetheless, it is cross-disciplinary and it invites people in from a broader spectrum of experiences. And so it becomes more inclusive overall.
This is why I need you. We're doing a talk together tomorrow morning. This is why I need her, because I just like ramble and she ties it all up in a neat little package.
I actually am coming from a different perspective, and I've said enough horrible things already. So I'm going to top it off again. To me, the fact that in the policy area there's so many more women involved has to me always been a kind of a signal that tech policy is the go-to area. It's being pulled out of the area of the stereotype of the geeky antisocial guys. The fact that we have so many relatively young women interested in policy and technology as intersecting was to me always a signal this is kind of something that is catching on.
I can only speak for myself, and I mean, I suppose for a few people I've talked to, but for me, it's because I'm not seeing the policies that I want that serve me. And I'm not saying that men don't have reasons for wanting to change those policies as well. They sure do. And there's so many. I mean, I'm at EFF, which is actually quite gender balanced, not perfectly, but almost portion of our leadership is female.
I actually have been teasing Joe McNamee of Adri of having a harem hanging about, because that office is mostly filled with young, exceedingly smart and attractive women.
Yeah,
and
he says,
well, I only get attractive, smart, policy oriented women to apply for jobs here. It's just kind of the
I mean, all jokes aside, though, I mean, I'm the reason I'm nodding and smiling is because it's true. I mean, that's another space, and that's, you know, sort of Edry's like kind of a cross section of Europe in that sense. So it's great to see so many women in leadership roles. Regardless, I think there are also a lot of wonderful men in leadership roles in the tech policy area, too. I think that what you're getting at, though, is that for me, it's about the fact that, you know, I want to change these policies because they don't serve me. And perhaps that's why you're seeing so many women, because perhaps the policies aren't serving us.
Okay. I think we're kind of hitting the end of the program. And you've been kind of all over the place. I would like to thank all of you, invited and uninvited guests. None of you are any less welcome than the others. For this interesting perspective, and I'm going to throw in some random Creative Commons stuff.
All right. I wanted to end off with inclusivity being the key feature of the important things inside of a hackerspace in the Middle East or anywhere, but like really the Middle East. Inclusivity, which means cross-disciplinary, inclusivity, which means hospitality, inclusivity, which means safe space.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I think the primary, like there's a lot of reasons to start a hackerspace. I think one of the primary values of a hackerspace that's happening in Beirut should really be inclusivity. And think from that will drive a lot of awesome stuff.
Serious question. Cairo is having hackerspace, Beirut is, but they're all in the Levant. And to me, the Middle East is not a monolithic thing.
It's not. It's very
definitely not.
Wait, what's not? What's
there are hackerspaces outside the Levant.
Yeah. Well, forget hackerspaces. I was wondering about Tunisia, the Maghreb, and all that.
North African Middle East.
Yeah, well, I was more interested on the western flank, like Tunisia, Morocco, and